Welcome to the Bloody Broads Pod. We're your Bloody Broads. I'm Bhavna Sharma.
And I'm Jamie Howard. Welcome to our 1 year anniversary episode.
Ooh, we made it, guys.
We did make it. So this week we have a very special guest. He is a horror community icon, editor-in-chief of Fangoria magazine, and a very good friend who I'm very honored to have on, Phil Nobel Jr. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's like your 1 year anniversary too. Very special.
Yes.
I'm honored.
No, well, we knew we wanted to have you on, but I was like, let's just save this for a rainy day, a good day. So, Phil, if you want to talk a little bit about sort of how long you've been in the horror world and kind of what you're doing now.
How long have I been in the horror world? I mean, do you mean professionally or just like in my personal life? I mean,
both.
First movie I can remember seeing is a horror movie. And, you know, I had older brothers who would expose me to things, I guess, before I was probably ready for them.
Yep.
That sounded terrible. They would expose me to horror movies is what I mean to say. And that's it. Just horror. No.
Just horror movies.
And so a lot of your classic horror movies I ingested as bedtime stories that they would just tell me about. You know what I mean? Like I knew the Halloween story as a story my brother Dean told me before bed, not before I knew it as a movie. So that's right. Sort of, you know, and so I grew up with these movies as sort of urban legends, including the one we're talking about today, where I would just hear about it from them and not be able to see it myself. And I got two books for one Christmas when I was a kid. One was a book about horror movies and the other one was a book by Tom Savini, a makeup artist. And both books covered Dawn of the Dead pretty extensively. And so I got very excited about seeing it. And it was right around the VCR revolution. And so it was one of the first things I ever rented. But I knew it up and down. I knew every kill in this movie before I'd seen it because of the Savini book, because he outlined every kill in the book. And so it was like, you know, watching it, like waiting for all the greatest hits to happen. So this movie is very much, I didn't mean to jump ahead, but this movie is very much tied to my horror origin story. It's been there almost since the beginning.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you did. Because this movie was actually one of the very first, not the very first horror movie I saw, but its predecessor actually was. So we are talking about 1978's Dawn of the Dead today. Phil picked this movie and I was so glad when he did, because this movie, I think, really cemented horror for me as something that was not only scary, but something that was existential. Yeah. And we can dive right in. I'm so glad you brought this up. So the first horror movie I ever saw was actually Night of the Living Dead. And then a couple years later, I had heard about this movie and my brother, I also have an older brother, he's 6 years older than me. And he was like, you can't watch the sequel. Like, this is too gory for you. Which, looking back now in 2022, is like, okay. Yeah. But I did eventually end up watching this. I think I was about 14 or 15. I was late to the game relatively when I saw this. And one of my favorite bands at the time, it was this hardcore band called Showbread. And all of my like former church kids are going to immediately know who I'm talking about when I talk about this band. They have a whole like conceptual EP built around this movie. And they actually have a song called Thank You, Toby Hooper. So I am very tied to this film. I just think this movie says so much in so few little bits of dialogue, including the opening. And I want to get right to the opening because, woof. After 2020, I don't know about y'all, but I have personally seen enough of people arguing whether or not a medical event is happening. And then, of course, like with the overturn of Roe versus Wade, I'm just overseeing two guys arguing about medical events on national television.
Me too, especially like, because it's the same two positions, just sub in your different medical emergency or non-emergency. It's the same. It's the one person going, please, I beg, listen to me. I am telling you how to survive. And the other one being like, this doesn't exist. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I'm, oh God. Watching, like you said, I rewatched it after I saw your notes. And then when it dove in, I was just like, oh God, I can't. I had to like pause for a second and then go back in. I'm like, all right, we're good. We got this.
It's sort of a perfect, unsubtle bit of satire for a 12 or 14 year old horror fan to digest, because if you catch it at the right age, this is the movie for me, and maybe it was for you too, where you're like, oh, these movies can be about something. It's not just waiting for the gore effect to happen, which, as I was saying, was literally how I watched it the first time. I'm waiting for the Savini effect, and then that happened. But what sunk in was like, oh, there's craft here, and there's subtext, and there's commentary. Which in the VHS heyday, you would rent anything that was a horror movie and you'd find out very quickly what was just sort of trash and what was kind of doing something a little more interesting. And Romero, and I think this is the other reason this movie resonated so hard for me, is that Romero, movies were complete fantasy, like something untouchable, something you couldn't imagine doing or being part of. And then you saw Romero where you're like, this is a guy in Pittsburgh with a close-knit team of buddies, and they're just making this movie. And you can kind of see the seams, but they're kind of triumphing over the seams, and it's still great. And that was a really empowering thing, too, for anybody who's got creative aspirations when you watch this movie, that you can make a movie that is attainable. It's within reach. You know, he just shot this in a mall during Christmas season at night. He closed down they closed down the mall. They took down the Christmas decorations, filmed their stuff. It's attainable. It's cheap. It doesn't have to be trash or one notch above pornography. It was actually intelligent filmmaking. And if you had any kind of dream of filmmaking as a kid, something like this was incredibly empowering to watch.
100%. I just rewatched, I was telling Bhavna this before we started recording, I just rewatched that Making of documentary that came out 15 years after this came out. It was early 90s. And realizing that they were just like, hey, all these Pennsylvania rednecks, we need you to show up in a field and pretend to shoot at zombies. And everyone in Pittsburgh was like, yeah, great, sure. Mm-hmm.
Who's got a helicopter?
Yeah.
we need at least two.
Yeah. Bhavna and I talk about that helicopter all the time because we'll talk about it later. But yeah, Fran just being like, I'm going to learn to fly this helicopter. F y'all. Mm-hmm. Love it. And I just, on top of that, sort of with the aspirations, I mean, this was the first horror movie that wasn't a Hitchcock film where I really recognized the soundtrack setting the tone. Obviously, now as an adult, I'm a huge Argento fan. That's what we talked about a couple episodes ago with Ian Carpenter. And just Romero himself said that this is a scary comedy more than it's a comedic scary movie. And I think 100% the soundtrack sets the tone for that. I talk a lot about the scene of the zombies stuck on the escalator. I think that that's A, good comedic timing, and B, such a smack in the face in terms of, you know, hey, America, you're a very consumerist society. And I love the line about, they've returned to what they know. And it's the fucking mall, all things. But this was the first horror film that wasn't Hitchcock that made me go like, oh, the movie is clearly affecting how I feel about this scene. And I think the kind of wacky, not carnival music, but upbeat.
Benny Hill's cousin.
Yeah. I feel very strongly about the soundtrack to this film.
Go ahead, Phil.
No, please, go ahead.
I was just about to say, this was like the first zombie movie I'd ever watched in my life. I watched this middle school, because one of my friends in middle school was just like, you love scary movies and you've never seen a zombie movie. I'm like, no, I haven't. And so we're like, all right, we're going to watch this. And I'm like, it's rated R. I'm a baby. I can't do this. but anyway, watched it, loved it. I'm a soundtrack person. You might not know this, Phil, but I love soundtrack, film scores. I love soundtracks. I love everything to do with music, with movies. And the music definitely stuck with me so much so that when Shaun of the Dead came out, I was that annoying person when I went to go see it underage, tapping my friend being like, this was in Dawn of the Dead. They used this in Dawn of the Dead. That's right from Dawn of the Dead. Like, this is a direct reference. And my friend being like, shut the fuck up. We're in a movie right now. Full disclosure, Shaun of the Dead is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Sure, it's a masterpiece.
And I was literally watching it because now, before we were recording, because I was in the mood for it. But but it's just how the music almost became more iconic to me than the actual movie itself for a while. Like, you can't hear any piece of that score and not automatically transport yourself to that mall or see one of those like ash-faced zombies.
And I think an underrated thing that people don't give enough credit to, and it's only kind of now just getting its due with some of the bonuses in the box sets that are happening, but that move, that soundtrack that we can hum right now if we were asked to, it's only partially Goblin. The other bulk of this soundtrack is from the DeWolf Music Library. It was Romero literally in there doing needle drops and colliding in parts some of those library tracks with Goblin stuff. Like, he would put a Goblin sting on a piece of like elevator music almost. And and if you get the new box set that I think is put out by, I think, Second Sight, they've got the DeWolf cuts on a CD in there that you can check out. But there's a guy named Chris Stavrakis who, his brother is one of the bikers in the movie, who went and hunted these DeWolf tracks down 15 years ago and would like send them on like, I don't know, LimeWire or whatever the fuck we were using back then. Oh my God, that's the library track from that scene. But as you guys just demonstrated, you view it as one work. And I think that's a testament to Romero's ear in terms of being able to meld those sounds and deciding how much Argento was too much Argento and sort of dialing back the Goblin stuff here and there.
And I think you just brought up something really specific and really important. How much Argento is too much Argento? Because you can 100% hear and see his influence. But being a huge Argento fan now as an adult, I'm like, thank God George was that actual genius who was like, let's reel this back in for a second. Because this, had he really dove deep into that sensibility, this would not have been a success in America. American audiences, I mean, I wasn't alive in 1978, but I'm just going to go out on a limb and say they probably were not ready for what that would have been. Yeah. I mean, well, that is
the Argento cut of the film, which he cut like, I don't know, 10 minutes out of the movie and sort of carpeted it with the Goblin music. And it's not the same film, but it was just a real canny decision on the part of Rubinstein, the producer, and Romero to be like, yes, you give us this money and then you do whatever you want with the movie over in Italy and we get this cut here. And I don't know. I think it's, again, just the scrappy roll up your sleeves resourcefulness of it, of like, yes, let's get in bed with Argento because he's going to pay for this movie and he's going to do what he wants with his cut and we're fine with it. Look, Romero wasn't precious about that kind of stuff. You know, you hear about directors that are control freaks and stuff, and Romero was just sort of just a blue collar filmmaker. There's something so accessible about his approach that still resonates with me today.
I am so glad you brought that up. Specifically, I'm thinking of the scene where they go to raid the mall before the bikers, like they're trying to shut everything up before the bikers get in. And he slides down the escalator, the middle of the escalator. That was completely that actor's choice. And I love that Romero was like, all right, so what do you think we should do in this scene? And when the actor, blanking on his name, sorry, y'all, you're going to hear me wheeze and laugh. My asthma's on like a 12 today. Yes, thank you.
Give him props. I wouldn't slide down.
He's amazing. 100%. If, especially as an actor, like having a director say like, oh, well, what do you think about this scene? And being able to pitch ideas and have that safety, and watching the making of documentary, I mean, and then rewatching this, you know, and I watch it several times a year. It's not that I had never thought of this before, but knowing that Romero is such a safe director for actors, you can see that in his work across every movie he made. Because, and we talk about this a lot from my perspective of being on set, when you're having to do a violent scene and you are the person that the violence is being perpetrated against, yes, they do go above and beyond to be like, are you okay? You know, do you need a break? That kind of stuff. But it's just as important for the person having to perpetrate the violence. You know, like my good friend Taylor played a killer and something with me, and he had to strangle me. And I was like, you good? Like, are you okay? And I love that Romero would check in on his, I just think he's kind of the antithesis to Hitchcock in a couple of different ways. Kubrick. Yeah. Bob and I have talked at length about Kubrick.
Sure. And the other kind of cool thing, again, is to you just sort of check in on these actors and realize that, David Emge, Scott Reiniger, and Ken Foree, they're all waiters. They were all waiters in a restaurant in New York when this movie got cast. And it's it's amazing because they're pretty charismatic. They didn't all go into like bigger careers necessarily, but Romero's eye for casting also doesn't get enough credit, I think. And it's just really, really such a great blend of the four people, those three gentlemen and Galen Ross. It's just, I don't know. I think he did something magical with not a lot of resources.
You know? Oh, 100%. Yeah. I love that Ken and Scott, whenever they're in any shot together, it's just so like little man versus big man.
Jeff,
Yes. It's my favorite. And I love hearing stories about how like Ken would ask Scott how he's doing. He's like, how's the weather down there? Or what's up, little man? Like, cause that's Ken's personality. And like, I specifically throughout this movie think that Ken kind of goes above and beyond in his role. I think that he is, I was sad when he didn't, you know, survive at the end, but I'm just thinking of specifically like, I mean, the second scene of the movie is the, you know, firing squad kind of busting into the housing project and how prescient that is to today and how it was in 1978. And, you know, one of the cops uses a racial slur. He says Puerto Ricans and just starts saying all these racial slurs. And I just, it's so still relevant to 2022. And I love that Ken's character specifically has to kind of navigate that as both a black man and a member of this like SWAT team. And then throughout the movie, he's like, all right, I have to be this leader. I don't know. I could gush about his performance forever.
And the art of his de-escalation in almost every single circumstance in this movie is just chef's kiss.
Oh my God. The scene with the priest. Yeah.
He's a result of, you know, Romero insists that the casting of Dwayne Jones in Night of the Living Dead was incidental. They didn't cast a black man on purpose. He was the best actor, et cetera, et cetera. But by 78, Romero has thoroughly bought into all the subtext that people picked up on Night of the Living Dead and leaned into it. And I think it's significant that his whole trilogy, and I know he made more movies, but the trilogy, there's never like really a white man protagonist. It's always a woman or a black man. And by the time he gets to like Land of the Dead, the protagonist is actually a zombie because he's like a big it's always the underdog, you know. By the time you get to Day with Bub and Land with I think Eugene Clark, it's he's thoroughly left humanity behind. But no, Ken is a spectacular actor in the film. And there was an article, I'm going to shamelessly plug Fangoria. There was an article we ran where we just reported on a bit of trivia where Romero was offered a bigger budget for Dawn if he would cast a name actor in the film. And the actor that was offered to him was O.J. Simpson.
No. So
you could have had a version of Dawn with a bigger budget and instead of Ken Foree, O.J. Simpson in the role, which would have ruined the movie in retrospect. I mean, it could have been a fine film at the time. Capricorn One's a fine movie, but you can't watch an O.J. performance now and
Wasn't that at the height of his like Samsonite commercials and weird primetime television?
All kinds of shit. And Romero's Laurel Productions, Rubenstein and Romero sort of paid the bills in between their features by doing these sort of like documentaries and industrials and that kind of thing. And they did a documentary on OJ called The Juice is Loose. And I think it was 76, but I'm not sure. But so he was in their orbit. He knew they knew who each other were, and that was the offer on the table apparently. But George did not want to cast OJ.
I'm gonna have to mute myself because I'm laughing so much that I'm wheezing. That is crazy. That's one of the fun facts I did not know. And that's why we have Phil on, you guys.
I'll send you the article. We did a really shameless Photoshop of OJ and Dawn of the Dead.
No. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to literally like start coughing. So Bob and I are special effects nerds, as it's no secret to people who listen to the pod. So the head that they blow up in that apartment scene in the basement, or not the basement, the second apartment they bust into. I learned that it was a plaster cast full of shrimp cocktail and condoms that were filled with fake blood. And I was like, excuse me, that is iconic. I had no idea that the special effects, I knew they were low budget, right? Like, I've always known this was a very DIY, you know, roll up your sleeves kind of film. But when I learned that, I had to like sit back and I just took a moment and I was like, wow, Romero was really like, hey, I want a head to blow up. Good luck making it happen. And then, of course, I did a deep dive into the infamous helicopter scene of the blade cutting off the zombie's, you know, head or top of their head. but yeah, it just, I think we really underestimate how much people are always saying, you know, oh, practical effects are so much better than CGI. And I agree. But I think we really underestimate now how little you actually need to make things seem realistic.
Well, yeah, it's a lot of editing. And you know, just to back it up for a second, everything that Romero asked Savini to do in this movie had never been done in a movie before, if you think about it. Right. There's no, you can't go down to that strip of stores in Burbank and to the horror store and get your head to blow up. You have to go make it. And get the head, I got more trivia for you. That head that he, that gets shot in the tenement thing is actually a cast of Galen Ross's head, the actress in the film, made up to be a black man. And they cast her head because the original ending of this film, she gets to the roof of the helicopter and also decides to kill herself and stands up in the blade. So they had cast her head for that gag. There's some very terrible photos of a test floating around on the internet. I don't know if they ever actually filmed it. But yeah, so they had her head in the shop. And so they sort of, I believe it was like a layer of latex backed by plaster. Like you slosh plaster around under that and then filled it with all that shit that you said. The shrimp cocktail and the blood condoms and whatnot.
Can't imagine what that would smell like after hours on set being like, yep, this is what we should do.
I bet he didn't use shrimp cocktail a second time.
Negative. And I know Bhavna, you have very specific feelings about these zombies in particular, color and all.
Yes. Okay. I find that this is so personally, this is my favorite zombie aesthetic. And it still is to this day. And I've seen a bajillion pieces of zombie media. This is still my favorite. I don't care. I find that when you get the more realistic looking zombies, you know, with the rotting flesh and the wounds and all that kind of stuff, like it's not for me. It's more terrifying when they just look like people.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, yeah, they don't like, you know, they're very, very different looking and very ashen and I don't know, like purple people eatery, but like, but it's still like, it's especially the one. So they're at the end and I rewatched the extended version. So I can't remember if this is, I've seen the extended version so many times. I can't remember if it's in the theatrical
best version
or not.
Yeah.
Right. So near the end, when it's all the bikers in the mall and everybody's going nuts, there's this one kid that they go to like, kill and he's still like half not fully zombified yet. I don't know if that was like a makeup fail or something. Like he was still like regular skinned like at the top of his head, but like the rest of him was like that grapey looking color. And they go in to kill him, but I find that more terrifying because then you kind of have to face the humanity of the person you're trying to destroy as opposed to like that person's gone, it's just a piece of rotting meat suit, like boom boom boom.
That's a good point. There's a quote by an art director named Bob Burns who did the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And he talks about how, I'm not going to use the right words, but I'll paraphrase. He, you know, there's a banality to real horror. There's a sort of everydayness, a matter of factness to it that, too many art directors, too many makeup artists, don't have the willpower to deliver. They go further and they want to impress you with their airbrushing and their vein work and their sculpting. And there's art to that for sure. But you know, the zombies in Thriller are beautiful because they're each one is a sculpture. Each one's a work of art. And that's not what these zombies are. And to have turned them into such a thing would have reduced that sort of matter of factness that I think you're talking about that makes it extra sort of existential and ultimately unsettling.
Yeah. No, that's exactly it. And I find that any, like, not that zombies aren't scary in any media going forward, but they've, to me, it's the most scary when they're like this, when they're still, they look mostly like you, they're just slightly different. There's not that many different indicators that they're not alive anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and Peter even says something that's, you know, I mean, it's the iconic line that his grandfather was a voodoo priest, and he says, you know, when hell's full, the dead are going to walk the earth. And I just, as a 14-year-old, I was like, oh, this slaps. Like, I was like, that's, you know, you like cling on to that. But the more we talk about what's realistic versus what's not, I mean, A, I agree with Bhavna. I think these blue zombies are significantly more terrifying than someone that looks realistic, because if they look realistic and they're attacking me, I'm going to be like, oh shit, that's a person attacking me. Let me protect myself. But if it's something that seems supernatural, I'm going to be just curious enough, I think, to kind of have that dazed look on my face that the whole team gets as the zombies infiltrate the mall. And, you know, Phil, you said something about the realistic makeup. I mean, Fangoria just did the cover with The Weeknd on it. And that's been one of my favorite stories that you guys did, with all the incredible special effects. And like, now there's a Halloween Horror Nights, you know, house of just The Weeknd, which is crazy. That was amazing. And I think it really speaks. Yes, it speaks to the idea that I think people are kind of hungry for that unreality, you know, like real life's already fucking tough. We need kind of a mental escape from it. And I think that's why this movie's special effects hold up, even though, you know, in the tenement house, the male zombie biting into his girlfriend's shoulder is so clearly fake. It looks, you know, it's like sponge, but who cares? Like, it's, I don't know. It still had an impact on me. But I will say, we are approaching what I feel is like, Bhavna, a commercial break.
Yes. So stay tuned for some more free thoughts after this.
All right, we are back from our commercial break, and we're going to jump right into some favorite character moments, starting with Fran. Fran is my favorite. I know that she is a lot of people's favorite in general, but to me, Fran is that bitch. She basically told the boys, she's like, y'all are going to teach me to shoot. You're going to teach me to fly this helicopter, and I'm going to survive. But I will say, being pregnant is my literal nightmare. So being pregnant during a zombie epidemic just seems, you know, another level. Not ideal. Fran was pre-Alien and pre-Sigourney Weaver, which I always harp on, I feel like, when I talk about her. Because I just find her take on kind of second wave feminism in the late 70s very interesting. Mm-hmm. She was the career woman, you know, like, she's like, I can't leave the station. I have to keep recording because it's my job. Everyone around her is like, you have lost your mind. We're in a literal zombie epidemic. We're getting the hell out of here. You know, I think she's kind of the blueprint for a lot of final girls that come after her. And it feels so reductive to even call her a final girl. She's a grown woman.
And she never gets any respect on those lists.
Never.
Everyone always forgets she exists. And I'm like, where's Fran, though?
I know.
Yeah, I think it's just because the people don't find her eligible for a final girl list. She didn't outlive any other girls necessarily in the film, right? And I think that the whole dynamic is different in this movie. But it's an interesting point, because she is a incredibly significant horror heroine. You talked about how the pandemic of it all was resonating for you when you watched the news guys arguing, but I had the pleasure of watching this movie at the Museum of Modern Art last month, and
yes,
and it was the 3D conversion, which thumbs down, but that's a whole separate story. But Galen Ross was there, which was cool. I've seen Galen at different events, and she, you know, she's a very accomplished documentary filmmaker now in her own right, by the way. But the moment in this movie that hit so different at this screening was, and I don't hold me to this, but I believe this was the week after Roe v. Wade got overturned. And Jesus. It's a packed house, and we're all watching the scene where the guys are talking about whether they should abort Fran's baby. And
yes.
There was like,
yes.
It wasn't like a laughter, like, oh, this is so dated. Ha ha ha. It was like an uneasy laugh of like, oh, fuck, because here we are again with men making choices for women's bodies, right? And it just hit so fucking weird. And like, it was like, there was a laugh and there was like a hush over the scene. But for a 44-year-old movie? 44?
Yeah.
Good God. Yeah. So there's so much going on there, and beyond just the how badass Fran is, but what she's dealing with in that film is sort of become newly relevant again, I think, in a weird way, sadly.
Yeah, it's like in rewatching it, it was just like I've seen it so many times that, like, not that I grew numb to it, but it's one of those things where it's like I already knew everything. I wasn't paying attention. But since it had been so long and I was looking at it with a critical eye to rewatch for our episode today, woof. Like we were saying with the opening, like you just said as well, like it hits very different right now. And wow, I think it's almost recommended viewing for people, but it's also refreshing to see, like, not refreshing, I should say depressing, to see that something made, like you said, 44 years ago. Sorry, I have no brain cells. I worked a full day today.
It's okay.
Short staff.
Wheels coming off the bus.
Oh, yeah. God. Were they ever on the bus is the question.
I mean, no. I did my part.
No, they were not. But it's just depressing to see a movie that was made 44 years ago be so relevant today in the wrong ways.
Oh, listen. And it's no secret to people that know me or that listen to the podcast. I do not want children. And it's been an uphill battle to, like, be a woman in a world that doesn't want to be a mother. And rewatching this, I mean, even at 14 years old, I knew I didn't want them. And so it hit me from the beginning, like, she is making a very clear choice to bring a child into this world that is bleak. It's very bleak. And not that 2022 is looking any better, but at the moment, knock on wood, we don't have actual zombies. Watch me say that. And then, like, the day after we release this episode, yeah, like, all hell breaks loose. But I mean, Peter, I make the joke all the time that he's our pro-choice king, because he tells her, he's like, you know, I know how to, if it comes to it, meaning he knows how to abort this child. And I just, watching this in 2022 and being someone that's very tapped into the, you know, my home state's Alabama. I do a lot of fundraising for the Yellowhammer Foundation. Bless y'all. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. They had to shut down because abortion is now effectively illegal in Alabama. And I mean, my God, like, having to, what you said, Phil, rely on a man to help you make this choice hits me harder and harder every time I watch this movie, both from a realistic political standpoint and as a woman who does not want children. On top of that, just being older, you know, like, I was 14 the first time I saw this movie. I'm 30 now. Like, it's a very different perspective. And Galen talks all the time, the woman that plays Bran, talks all the time about how she didn't know what she was doing when she was cast in this movie. Like, she hired this acting coach and she would bring these sides from the dailies to her acting coach and say, help me. But I think that was an advantage for her. I think her honesty and her realness is so refreshing because she's scared. I mean, she's scared shitless. And same thing with, I mean, it's funny to watch Scott be Roger and be so, I don't know. Roger just always cracks me up in this movie. He's so sure of himself. But to have Francine be so, Fran be so unsure of herself, and then Peter be this, like, stoic force. You know, people are always going to harp on this film for the DIY-ness, the gore, the Romero-ness of it all. I'm a huge Romero fangirl, but I think the acting... Right. I think the acting gets overshadowed by sort of the lore of it all. If that made any sense at all to people listening.
No, I get you.
Yeah, it's a lot. I got a lot of feelings about this one, you guys. But on top of that, we do kind of get the, what I would argue is a heavy-handed euphemism for capitalism. You know, this movie decimates the same concept we're still dealing with today.
It takes place in a mall and it's about capitalism?
What? Yeah. But more specifically,
be fair, the remake was set in a mall and managed to not be about capitalism. The remake managed to miss any kind of thematic resonance whatsoever. So, you know, it's not a given that it's going to have that theme.
I'm sorry, Phil. The only zombie movie that came out in 2004 was Shaun of the Dead. I know nothing of this remake you talk of.
What remake? We don't acknowledge its existence.
Enough.
But yeah, more specifically, I think outside of capitalism, of course, is just consumerism. It's a blanket mm-hmm. for our fears. It's our whole personality. And it's our whole sense of well-being, right? Like they're like, oh, a mall score. Like people joke all the time about like, if it's, if I'm able to get to a Costco in a zombie apocalypse, like I'm set. And I'm like, have none of you seen Dawn of the Dead? I mean, listen, this whole movie reminds me of those TikToks that are about quote unquote self-care, but that turn out just to be advertisements for like plastic junk items that you're supposed to use in your self-care routine. Bhavna knows I have a lot of feelings about mental health buzzwords that have been co-opted for the consumeristic agenda, but that is a whole other episode that would take us the whole hour to talk about.
I will say I do like that their reaction to a mall in 1978 is similar to what a child's reaction to a mall might be in 2022. What the hell is that? Well, it's a shopping center, you know, one of those big indoor malls. Like, well, why didn't you just go to Amazon? Like in 2022, a mall might be as alien. And I'm going to brag for a second, but when I was making the Shudder series that I did 2 years ago, or it aired a year ago, I had to go to Pittsburgh to interview Tom Savini, but I made my producer stop at the Monroeville Mall. This is mid-COVID virus, no vaccines, nothing is open. The mall was closed, but the doors were unlocked. So we wandered around the Monroeville Mall during the actual apocalypse. And I have the pictures. It was magical. It was empty. We ran around on the escalators. It was wonderful.
I'm gagged.
Did you slide down though?
No, because they put those little bumpers in there now. I would castrate myself. So.
Yeah, I feel like you'd hurt the family jewels on that one. Mm-hmm. It's so funny because when you said Amazon, I was like, well, that's the next of the dead movie is like the Amazon Prime deliverers that are trying to make these, you know, 3 day turnarounds now. It used to be 2 day, now it's 3 day. They're the only ones getting exposed to this virus. And like that's I just wrote the next blank of the dead, guys. Universe of the dead, whatever you want to call it. There you go. Tom Savini, call me. Prime of the dead. There it is. And you know what's wild to me is that Tom Savini is still around and still working and still has his school of special effects.
He's I went to his house to interview him for some stuff. He bought the house that he was born in.
So, what?
Because his parents had that house and he bought it or inherited it, but he was born in that house. He's lived in the same house his entire life. And it's like a brownstone in the city. So he bought the one behind it on the next block and connected them.
And that's this cool.
Hard dork playground with like just stuff all through every path you go. The bathroom is kitted out with stuff. It was, he's living his dream and he's a happy camper over there in Pittsburgh.
Oh man, that's right up there with Guillermo del Toro's Bleak House.
I was going to say GDT's house. Yeah.
I went to that exhibit twice and it was still not enough.
I know. Maybe we can get Tom to do some kind of like career retrospective exhibit. I don't know. Anyways, bringing it back to Monroeville. We find out, this is why we have notes, Phil. I told you. Not for you guys. It's for me and Bhavna.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So we get through the, we realize Fran's pregnant. We get to the best part of the movie outside of the biker gang attack, which is the trucks. I know, Bhavna, you feel specifically strongly about the trucks. I think that they represent for me a lot of American male masculinity. These big like Peterbilt Mack trucks that are supposed to be their savior. And then it winds up being the reason, you know, that he dies. So.
Oh, my God. Right. That's honestly my favorite, one of my favorite scenes, to be honest, in the entire movie. Yeah.
Peter losing it. Not Peter. Roger losing it.
Roger losing it.
There's an EC Comics sort of morality to the film that wasn't in Night of the Living Dead, a film where no one was safe, right? Which was really unsettling, where everyone here kind of who dies makes sort of a fatal flaw. Like whether it's Roger getting, you know, too cracked or overconfident, or Stephen getting too possessive of the mall, when they were just going to lock the doors and let the guys run roughshod. No, it's ours. And he pays for it with his life. There's a like a weird moral code to this movie that I think if I were going to change anything about the movie, I would maybe change that, because it telegraphs who's going to live and die a little bit too much.
Mm. Yeah. That's a bold change, yeah. But I like it.
Yeah.
I'd watch it.
Yeah. Well, mostly because I think like what you said about Steven getting super possessive over the mall kind of gets overshadowed. But I mean, he really is the reason why they all wind up screwed in the end. Like, he could have just said, hey, we're going to hide out in these offices upstairs. We have our canned food, whatever. Also, this mall having, sorry, this has nothing to do with this train of thought other than how my brain works. This mall having an ice rink is so, like, I would understand an ice rink because we have one here in the Mall of Georgia.
So 80s.
Yeah. And then what really throws me off is the grocery store question mark. Yeah. I don't know. You guys are going to have to enlighten me because I've never seen a mall like that outside of this.
Yep. There's
the mall I grew up with has it.
There's a grocery store in a mall. In your hair.
Okay.
It's when you get it more
mall. I mean, this was a real mall. They didn't fake anything.
Right. Right. That always blows me. I'm like, what? Like, this is, so I tweeted a couple of weeks ago that I was rewatching this, you know, for the umpteenth time, and a guy tweeted at me and said, I'm always so confused by the layout of this mall. And I'm like, well, it was actually Monroeville Mall. Like, it's real. And they had to work around. I always forget that it's during the Christmas schedule too. So having to take those decorations and put them back up and take them back down, just woof. But I think that watching this in 2022 adds that, again, it adds a fantastical element, because now we have dead malls. I mean, there's a whole YouTube channel called Dead Malls where, you know, the only thing that's around is a dry cleaner, you know, a shoe store, and I think like half the food court. Bleak times, you guys. But I think that ties back into kind of the consumerism thread.
The Monroeville Mall itself is sort of a half-dead mall at the moment. I mean, they had a Dawn of the Dead's 40th anniversary convention, and they had it in the mall. And they used four empty storefronts. Like, this was this storefront is where you got your autographs, and this storefront is where you bought your merch, and then the courtyard is where they had the Q&A panel. And there were a couple of, like, you know, like a Forever 21 or some shit in there, but there was ample real estate in that mall to have a full ass horror convention inside the mall, which is like a fun thing for us, but kind of sad news for the mall.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what do you do after the con?
Right. Well, what was that atmosphere like at that reunion? Because that's a milestone, you know, that people are still so into it.
Yeah. I wrote about it in our first issue about, I went to it. It was the first such gathering after Romero had died. So that was a bit of a Irish wake vibe to it, because both his ex-wife and his widow were there. His daughter was there. All of his living crew members that were there were there. Like, the whole cast came out. I think maybe one or two of the biker guys weren't there, but like, there were people there who had played zombies for, you know, 6 hours one day in 1978 and then got on with their lives. And, you know, somebody told them years later that they're on the poster, like the bald dude at the airport. He hadn't watched the movie until like 5 years ago, apparently. They all kind of had taken their weird journeys and then come back together for this sort of, you know, if you've ever been to a high school reunion, it probably felt like that for them. Oh, I remember you. You were the guy and you were, you know, the girl who gets her face blown off in the truck was like sitting there marveling at someone who had her tattooed on their arm. But, you know, she was a housewife in Minnesota at this point. You know what I mean? It was surreal. It was a very surreal vibe, and made all the more strange by it being literally in the mall. With tours available by a guy named Larry, who would show and have these pictures. He'd go, here's the shot where Peter leaned against his column. You see how the marble markings match? Like, here's the floor where this guy got his guts torn open. You can see because the floor patterns are the same. And he took you into the boiler room. It was, if you paid a little extra, you got to go on the roof. I didn't go on the roof.
That would be worth it only to have the selfie, I guess.
But the back hallways and stuff. It was delightful.
That sounds like a dream come true, only because I'm such a nerd. But like when you said he gets his guts ripped out, that is the scene that my brother was afraid of showing me, is the biker getting ripped apart. Yep. And that's, to me, that was the first time in a horror movie that I had to kind of like look through my, you know, look through my fingers. Because before this, I had kind of stuck to Scream, Night of the Living Dead, things where the horror, the gore was more implied. I don't know. I think for so many people, this film in particular was kind of their start of a true quote unquote gory journey versus, I don't know. I could wax poetic about the gore in this movie for a long time.
It was part of the, yeah, it was part of the sales of it though. I think they made a choice to release it unrated, and they let you know up front it's because of the graphic violence. And, you know, there was truth to that. Like, that movie would have gotten an X rating from the MPAA. Like, as long as Romero was making movies, he didn't have the leeway of like AMC does now with Walking Dead, where you're tearing people in half every week.
Yeah.
It's he couldn't shoot. He had said, I think in an old Fangoria, I can't get an R rating if I shoot a zombie in the head. But Rambo can do it all day long, but I can't shoot a zombie in the head or I'll get an X rating. The MPAA is not particularly, rude. You know, all knowing, all wise body. So they had a thing for horror.
Neither are most of those kind of committees and things, because I'm still mad that Lupita Nyong'o did not get any recognition for her role in Us. And I will talk about this till the cast come home. But similar vein.
We talk about this a lot to Blaine from Ladies and Ligaments. We talk a lot about pre-code movies and just the difference in what's rated X / NC-17 / R now versus, you know, in the 40s and the 50s. but very I think, different. You know, very different. And I think too, and this has definitely got a bearing on kind of why I wound up loving this film so much. I was raised so religious that it was subversive for me to watch this, but my parents had no problem with me watching the Ten Commandments or Ben-Hur, which has a guy literally getting his arm chopped off as he's rowing the boat, you know, or for heaven's sakes, The Passion of the Christ is an R-rated movie. Like, it's pretty graphic.
Yeah.
But I would get in trouble for sneaking these horror films behind their back. That. And I think, it's a very American sensibility.
Well, I mean, I grew up on the most violent Hindi movies you can imagine. Like, I was watching people be blown up. I was watching people get, like, in totally, totally unrealistic action sequences, get, like, their guts ripped apart and all this stuff. I mean, you know, on a Sunday afternoon with the family, sitting on the couch, just watching it. God forbid anybody kissed, though. That's when you had
to. Is that right?
Yeah.
Pump the brakes, Bob. That's some racy shit right there.
Yeah, no, I remember, like, anytime there was, like, any kind of romantic overture, it was like, nope, can't watch with the kids. But, you know, I can watch some dude get his head blown off.
Right.
It's great. I could probably name you a couple of those movies. But if I watched an English language horror movie where this kind of stuff happens, oh, no. She's getting exposed to violence.
Interesting. I think that weird double standard is very prevalent in American culture still, and even in horror fans. I think horror fans will let their kids run around in, I mean, you've seen it at conventions, they'll let them run around in Freddy costumes and let them watch those movies, but won't let them see, you know, a pair of breasts.
Right. We talk about this a lot with kids that dress up as Michael, especially because I get tagged in that because people know that I love Friday the 13th films in general. Not Friday the 13th. Jesus, Halloween. You said Freddy. No, you got Freddy on my mind now. People know that I love Halloween. And so they'll tag me and, like, there's all these little kids on TikTok right now wearing the Michael, you know, mask, doing like TikTok dances. And I'm like, does that child know who you're dressing him up as? I'm going to say no. I'm going to start giving you guys my final thoughts because I know I'm going to give you time to get to yours. Something that I think really sticks out to me on top of the consumerism, on top of the freedom of choice, is the redneck scenes. The redneck and the biker scenes especially really cement this layer of American society that I think gets kind of taken for granted in more modern horror films. Some of us think that as long as we are armed, we are safe. We see that with post Uvalde shooting, you know, people more and more got louder and louder about giving teachers guns, as it's that, if that's supposed to solve something. I shudder to think about what George Romero would be making if he were alive today, given that almost everything he talked about in his films has sort of come true in a sense, mm-hmm. and how we perceive current events. I think about him a lot in general, but especially when it comes to that. And I don't know, I think this is such a snapshot of Americana that this film is, I can't believe it's almost 50 years old, but it's so classic that I just, for me, it's always going to be in my top five, easy. But yeah, that was kind of my closing thoughts, was that it's a snapshot of American life. So you guys run with it.
Oh my God. Phil, you want to go?
Well, no. If I can, sure. You know, you asked me what my favorite movie was, and I always resist that kind of answer because I don't like to rank films or list films. But when I thought about like impact and how much I, what are the films that I invested time of my life in, right? And I think if there's a film where the location was one of the stops on my honeymoon, or like, or that I've been to three times since then, or, you know, that I've bought on every format that's, you know, come out before I could even play it on that format. It has to be Dawn of the Dead. Dawn of the Dead is just a movie that got into my brain at a very specific age. And for the reasons I said above, about how it showed me what was sort of possible in the horror genre, beyond just gross out and beyond, you know, taboo and testing my own limits, it gave me a bit of insight into the hand behind the paintbrush, I guess. You know, Romero was an early lesson in maybe not having the most beautiful equipment to get the most magical shots, but if he had 20 shots, he could make a sequence out of that. And to me, it boils down to the airport scene in the film where they land, mm-hmm. it's empty. There's a threat introduced. There's a parallel threat introduced, you know, in this space, there's a third threat introduced in this space, and he's cutting between all of it. And he's showing you drama. He's creating drama out of editing, and he edited his own films up until 1982. And I think that that's kind of magic as well. And then on top of all that, he ultimately presents as the biggest threat in the film, a dumbass guy with a gun who's shooting right. willy-nilly at somebody who he's supposed to be allied with. And I just, anytime anybody wants to know why I love this movie or what's so special about this movie, that's the sequence I show people. And when I went to Monroeville, I found the airfield and went to it, and I took a piece of that helicopter landing pad because it was crumbling, and I have it upstairs. And it's
amazing.
It's just such a perfect piece of regional independent American filmmaking. He used these locations that he knew about and just created something that I think is just magic.
I'm like swooning all over again about why I love this movie. Nice. it's so good. All right, Bob, shoot.
I'm going to go on a tangent before I get to my final thoughts.
I'm okay with that.
You just inspired me, Phil.
Okay.
I was just recently in my cousin's wedding. My cousin Johnny, she was on the pod a couple episodes ago. Evil Eye, but I was in her wedding and she was tossing and turning between a few different places to do the wedding photos. And then she finally picked Dundurn Castle. And now if you've seen Crimson Peak, which I'm assuming you have, mm-hmm. I assume everybody's seen Crimson Peak. It's one of my favorite movies. But it's Dundurn Castle is where they shot both the park scene and the funeral scene. So like that big kind of like mausoleum-esque tombstone, you know, two for one. So we shot wedding photos there. So the entire time, like, it's in the heat. I've had makeup on my face since 4 a.m. I'm in giant heels. I'm like in a really nice outfit, super femme. And all the while I'm going like, don't nerd out right now. Don't be like, aha. So that's where they sat. That's where the dead butterflies were. That's where, you know, all this stuff is. But I just, so much stuff is shot around here that I love, like the diner from Shape of Water is actually a diner that I actually walked by the other day. But like, you know, it's like I just get that sense of like, yeah, it's my city. Yeah. These are things that like, you know, I can go to every day that they've got a separate meaning, but like, you just get that like flutter in your heart when it's something that you're that connected to. And it's just like, shut up. You can just get a piece of pie here. It's fine. But it's like, no, but this is where this happened. Anyway, that's just how my brain works, Phil. Now, you know,
and you've got all those Kronenberg locations in Toronto.
That's what we were. Yeah. We've talked about that on a couple of, couple of different episodes. We've talked about Cronenberg filming around Toronto and how much we love him.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. If you're not from Toronto and you're not a film fan, if you don't have some kind of like 6 degrees of Cronenberg going on, and mine is that like a good friend of mine, was a model for one of his daughter's, photo collections.
Okay.
Oh, but I love, yeah. What a angel.
That's my little Cronenberg connection. But back to Dawn of the Dead. sorry, guys. This movie will forever be my favorite zombie movie. Like, forever and ever. Like, yeah, it was my first, but you just can't watch any piece of zombie media without seeing a reference. There's nothing, like, I challenge our listeners to find me something zombie related that doesn't have some kind of reference, whether on purpose or by accident, to this movie. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have, nobody has an independent zombie thought that didn't come from this movie. Mm. Like, in any way, shape, or form. Like, I'm sorry, there's just nothing out there. And right, like, I mean, Shaun of the Dead has the most, but I mean, Edgar Wright was really just gunning for all the references there. Like, from the news channels to the music to like somewhat of the plot. But honestly, like, even when you get like the different kinds of zombies, like your fast versus slow and all that kind of stuff, there's still so many overlapping things with this film that you just can't. So why love a knockoff when you can love the original? Like, I can appreciate all the subsequent zombie media. Like, I liked the comics for The Walking Dead, and I liked the show up until a point, and then I just gave up. Because I can't. I'm like, you can't make this interesting for me anymore. I give up. I don't even care about the people anymore. Just, I'll die. but this is one of the movies that, like, if I was going to give someone a horror starter pack and I wanted to give them just, like, a little bouquet of what's out there for them to start their own journey, like, not my journey, but just their own journey, this would be one of the ones I would give. Even if I had to, like, shorten that to, like, 3 movies, this would still make the cut. Well, so if you haven't seen this and you're still listening, please go and watch it, because you don't know what you're missing.
And its producer doesn't make it easy for you.
No. We have discussed this a couple different times that I have found this on YouTube, and I have tried to give people my money to have this streaming, but it's not a thing.
There's a real nice HD version on YouTube, and you do what you have to do.
Yes, there is.
It's also the superior version with the extra 10 minutes, 12 minutes of added.
We're going to agree to disagree on that, but okay.
Oh, I love it. Cannot believe you, Phil.
But you can find 2004, you know, that movie that doesn't exist, everywhere.
It's in the Walmart $5 bin.
You can't even find it in Google Movies. Like, I was like, look, I'll pay the $5, $10, $15 for, you know, the movie, and it's not even in there.
Yeah.
I know. Well, Phil, thank you so much for giving us your time today. It's greatly appreciated. Happy 1 year anniversary to everybody listening.
Congrats. We love,
thank you for being on. Thank you, everybody that's listened. Phil, we always give our guests the chance to say where people can find you if you want them to find you on the internet.
Definitely do not want to be found on the internet, but if you go to fangoria.com, you can see everything that's going on our website. You can subscribe to the magazine or buy an individual issue if you just want to try one. And every week we put a new vintage issue up as a PDF for you to read for free. And so we're up to issue 75, I think, from the original run. Plenty of stuff on there to poke through.
We love it. Bob and I are, yes, leave Phil alone. He's a busy man.
Yes.
Bob and I are subscribers, you guys. You should also subscribe as well. It's well worth your money. You can find us as at Bloody Broads Pod on Twitter and Instagram. You can email us bloodybroadspod@gmail.com. And Bhavna, if people didn't like this episode, where can they leave it?
In a 5-star review. And we might read it.
Maybe. All right, guys, until next time. Bye.
Bye.